Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Big game today.
Oh, yeah.
Big showdown between United States and Iran in the World Cup to see who advances to face Equatorial Guinea or something. I don't know.
Come on, you're going to watch it, right? Everyone's watching it. They're even watching it at school today, I think. My son's going to be watching it, yeah.
Of course. Why? What else would they be doing at CPS?
Hey,
certainly not learning to read or do math. Yeah, of course.
It's in study hall. Come on.
Yeah. No, I'm not going to be watching it. But I know some family members of the Iranian soccer team, the players in the Iranian soccer team are going to be watching it because they're under threat of death after the Iranian team expressed some solidarity with the protesters in Iran. So they better mind their P's and Q's on the Iranian side. Interesting, you know, clash of cultures here. You would think after sending them pallets of cash and putting them on a glide path to nuclear weapons, you'd think that they may take a dive. But again, they got family members to worry about that. Apparently the mullahs have a sword to their throats.
And what did you think of the U.S. Soccer Federation? I mean, they took the Iranian flag and they took the Islamic Republic part out of it, and they're upset about that. Now they're demanding that the game be canceled.
I don't think of the U.S. Soccer Federation. That's what I think of the U.S. Soccer Federation. I don't. So, yeah, forget all the soccer silliness.
Well, they're
Babylon
pissed
I'm
about
sorry.
It. I said, well, Iran is pissed about it, and they want the game canceled because we were being disrespectful to them.
Well, the game goes on, and the bloviations go on, and then the fights in the stands go on, whatever.
The fight started yesterday with reporters and a soccer player, said soccer player.
You're pronouncing our country's name wrong.
Yeah.
Our country is named Iran, not Iran.
Got it.
My apologies on the mispronunciation of your country.
Got it? We got to pronounce it right. Iran
is a Flock of Seagulls song. Iran is the country.
Thank you.
Babylon Bee has given me an idea, enlist the listeners for help on this, ways to make soccer watchable. They've offered 10 to get your propeller spinning here. Ways to make soccer watchable. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. If you have any suggested reforms to make soccer watchable, as it currently is not, as everyone understands. Number one, goalies must be double amputees.
Oh, Dan. Yeah. And their name's Matt. Oh.
Well, I mean, the point is to minimize the scoreless draws.
Okay, what's...
not bad.
Ooh, ouch.
Supply one enforcer on each team with a taser. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's number funny. Number three, add quicksand so that anyone who takes too long on a free kick gets sucked in. You either move or you die. I like that. Yeah, this is sort of like soccer meets Squid Game. I kind of like this idea. Number four, have a drunk hobo decide when each half starts and ends because it's, I mean, what's the difference? But at least it would be entertaining. Number five, in the event of a tie, the coaches must duel at midfield. I like that.
Two enter, one leaves.
Honor at stake there. Right? Number six, if players pass the ball 10 times without shooting, the ball detonates. It's not bad. Yeah. Number seven, these are ways to make soccer more watchable, as it currently is not. Release an enraged bull on the field if things get boring. Have a little so soccer
like
meets.
It becomes a Spanish bullfight.
Yeah, soccer meets Pamplona. You know, I think I mentioned this before on the show.
What?
I had a classmate in high school who died in Pamplona.
Oh, running with the bulls?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What year was that?
It was a while back. The ironic thing is that he was voted in our yearbook most likely to die by getting gored by a bull.
No, he didn't.
Number eight, anyone who flops will be thrown in the Sarlacc pit where they will discover a new definition of pain and suffering. Do you know what the Sarlacc pit is, Amy? This is a geek test.
No, I don't. I don't. Oh, my God. Well, Mike's outraged.
I'm not surprised you don't.
Justin, who didn't know who...
This is somebody who just watched The Godfather.
Oh,
recently.
Okay.
I did, and I'm watching Godfather
movie
2 this
reference.
Sunday. Yes, movie reference.
Mm-hmm. Movie Sarlacc reference.
Are we playing syllable, sounds like.
I'll give Amy a hint because, you know, for the rest of us geeks, it's well known.
I was busy going
to prom. This is a hint that you have. I mean, even if you haven't seen it, just for cultural reference, you should know.
Okay.
Jabba the Hutt.
Oh, some Star Wars thing?
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Very good. All right.
What's it called again?
The Sarlacc Pit. It's in the Great Pit of Carcoon.
Oh, that's...
Yeah, that's
this
a real...
This Carcoon you speak of. Okay.
That's a real geek test.
Wow.
You know, the Great Pit of Carcoon. All right, back to... Let's round out the list here.
Okay, so go into the Sarlacc Pit.
Jeez. Anyone who flops will be thrown in the Sarlacc pit. I like that. Number nine, ways to make soccer watchable. Give half the players jetpacks and half the players surface-to-air missiles.
Oh, too soon.
And then, that's a built-in spot. Too soon for what? Then it's a built-in, and then you get the Lockheed Martin sponsorship.
Oh.
And wear that on their jerseys. And then number 10, to make soccer more watchable. Instead of kicking a round ball towards a goal, players will carry or throw a more oblong ball towards a kind of end zone.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like football. Yes.
Very good.
Thank you.
Marty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
All right, here's what you do to make soccer more watchable. One of two things. You either take a nap or else you go to Pluto TV and watch an hour of Gunsmoke and then go back. And the game will still be, say the clock is 15,000 minutes on it, and it'll still be the same score, so you take another nap. And then it'll finally end in a scoreless tie, and that's all you can do with soccer.
That sounds like baseball to me, by the way. Take a nap, third inning, take a nap, fifth inning, take a nap, seventh inning, take a nap, extra innings, baseball.
Well there's
at least in soccer, you have a definite end to the game. In baseball, they can play till the next day.
A definite end. When you go into this extra time, how long is extra time? This is one of these unknowable things. How long is extra time?
No, it's kept track of by an official up in the and it's usually determined exactly by a timekeeper on the field, which holds up a big sign that says this much extra time.
And it's different extra time with each match.
It's based on injury because the game
continues. Because everybody's flopping around like Dennis Rodman.
Because the game continues while somebody is injured. They don't take a seven-minute timeout to cart somebody off who's got an alleged pulled hamstring.
But the thing is, there's so much acting in soccer. It's so much drama. I mean, I one time had a soccer player who joined volleyball, and I said, well, this isn't soccer, buddy, because he went down with a... ankle, he's like, oh, my ankle!
That's why
we don't do that in this sport, buddy.
That's
get
not
off
drama.
The court.
No. Real sports have real drama. Well, that is melodrama.
Yeah. That's why Dan's suggestion that they are armed if they flop is a good idea.
Well, they get thrown into the Sarlacc.
Or that, too.
Yeah.
Either one is fine by me. Like duels at pistols. Flopping is just insane.
Well,
it shouldn't happen, and it should be penalized, and it should be – you're never going to outlaw it.
But
you just never know,
Mike, if anybody's really injured.
The late Kobe Bryant perfected it in the NBA.
Rodman. right.
Well, that was another kind of flop, but yeah.
Well, and that worked on multiple levels with Rodman. Why don't you just skip all this and just go right to the – I mean, do they still have – the penalty kicks?
They do.
Yeah, those are fun. Yeah,
just go right to that. Best out of, you know, whoever gets the most out of 10.
forget the first two halves.
Just go right to the penalty kicks.
For some games, that would be appropriate, I think.
Everybody protects their family jewels.
Even in the World Cup.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch today. I guess I'll watch.
Of course you'll watch today.
And then I'll probably fall asleep during it.
Kip in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, to utilize their arms and hands, I think when you got the ball or you're defending the guy with the ball, you get to throw up to two punches.
Two punches.
You got it.
All right. Two punches. Anybody, the guy with the ball, so this becomes like a smear, what we used to call smear the, you know.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That element, too, I think would make it more interesting. I mean, you know, you can wear headgear or mouth guard or something if you want.
All right.
Frank in Arlington Heights.
Okay, turn them into foosball players, like, you know, tabletop foosball, where you have five guys in a row, and you have, like, three rows of them, and they're tied to, like, some sort of, like, pole, and the only way they can hit the ball is if they, you know, completely go a 360, just like in the game. That's it. That would be fun to watch.
Soccer ball becomes human foosball. That's not bad.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That's not bad. Thanks for the call, Frank. A lot of good ideas. We'll be taking your ideas how to make soccer more watchable, as some of you, apparently, if you're a student of CPS, are going to be forced to watch
Study
USA
Hall.
Versus Iran today. Iran.
Iran.
Iran. Iran. Iran, flock of seagulls, Iran, you know, a country in the Middle
East. Thank you.
Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
And the other flock of seagulls hit.
I know it's on my phone.
I'll give you a hint. It was featured in Career Opportunities with Frank Whaley and Jennifer Connelly.
Oh, I have it on my playlist.
The roller skating through the...
Right, the roller skating through the mall.
Through the store, yeah.
Or through the store. Wow.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Spaceballs.
Spaceballs. Yes, that's it. Spaceballs. Right. Yeah.
Rick Mel Moranis. Brooks and Spaceballs. No. Space Age Odyssey.
Space Age Love Song.
Or that.
You could give her. Mike. You could have gone Space Age Love, and it would still. It wasn't going to happen. It was not going to happen.
No, no, no. It's all right. It's all right. Baby steps. You know, this Godfather movie you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is really something.
Has anybody seen The Godfather?
Man, Sonny in the toll booth and then the horse's head. Ooh.
Hey, don't ruin it for anybody who hasn't seen
well,
it.
Well, I'm seeing Godfather 2 this weekend, so do not tell me how it ends. I don't want to. No, no, no. Don't say.
No, we won't.
But I will tell you this. Diane Keaton is hotter now than she was back then. Don't you think she's aged beautifully?
Uh-huh.
This is the Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank. Member FDIC. Equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So this case that we've been tracking, and except for some local media in L.A., the D.C. Press Corps has not been tracking, the D.C. Press Corps writ large, all their outposts around the country. This is the case of the individual who ran into some five or six dozen L.A. County Sheriff's deputies during a run and injured severely injured, several of them, injured 25 overall, some severely injured, limbs were lost. Also, one L.A. Sheriff's deputy, who's also Army Reserve, Alejandro Martinez, he is still in grave condition. He's still fighting for his life. Now take a listen to this report from the NBC affiliate in L.A.
Alejandro Martinez was among the most critically injured in the crash in mid-November, and he remains in the hospital at UCLA Ronald Reagan tonight. But today, for the very first time, we are hearing from Alejandro's family, and they shared this picture with us as part of their online fundraiser helping with medical bills. And they tell us that he remains in critical condition right now. Alejandro is just 27, a new recruit who also serves in the Army National Guard and hopes to one day become a sheriff. They say he's a huge sports fan. He cheers for the Rams, Lakers, and Galaxy. And his family says he has a huge heart and is always the life of the party. His family is hoping tonight that everyone can keep him in their prayers. This update comes just days after the Sheriff's Department hosted this benefit barbecue in Norwalk. 100% of the proceeds were for the recruits who were hurt. And we know that some of the money has already gone to them and their families. Organizers say they raised roughly $70,000 at the event, and they've taken in an additional $50,000 in checks, cash, and PayPal that have been sent or dropped off with the Sheriff's Relief Fund directly. Now, amazingly, they say the majority of these donations are $20 to $100. Thousands of people doing everything they can to help. And so many people have these recruits on their mind as they recover again.
What's missing from that report? What's missing?
Any comment about the person who is responsible for this?
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of forgot about that, huh?
Exactly. So this guy's name, he was arrested, charged with attempted murder, then he was released. His name is Nicholas Gutierrez, and right before Thanksgiving, which is part of the reason it sort of got lost in the holiday right. shuffle, Nicholas Gutierrez sat down with his dad and his attorney to do an interview with that same NBC affiliate, and well, take a listen.
The sheriff says you did this intentionally. Is that true?
No, that's false.
Nicholas Gutierrez says he doesn't remember exactly what led up to the crash, but he knows it was not deliberate.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, just apologies to what happened. It wasn't intentional.
Nicholas was going to work as an electrician, installing solar panels on what started as a routine day. Law enforcement sources told the NBC4i team a witness saw Nicholas looking down, possibly at a mapping device or possibly dozing off.
I take the same route every day.
So you were familiar with the area?
Yes.
The crash happened early Wednesday morning in the South Whittier area near Mills Avenue and Trumbull Street. The class of about 75 recruits was on a training run when they were hit.
Some of the recruits said you didn't brake. What do you remember? Anything at all about this?
I fell asleep at the wheel and I woke up to people banging on the window to get out. I had no words. When I got out, I asked if they were okay and they pulled me out and took me to the ground.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It's great that the NBC affiliate got this interview. It's unfortunate that, like most of these, most of the reporters generally that work for corporate media, are just so bad at their jobs, they just don't ask any of the right questions, and they're not listening to the answers, so they don't follow up right. with any of the probing questions that should be asked. For example, so let me understand something. It's 6:30 in the morning. You're going to work. Why were you so tired? You're so tired at 6:30 in the morning. Ostensibly, you just got up, and you're going to work to install solar panels. So you're so tired that you fell asleep at the wheel?
What did you do the night before?
Well, and there's no indication that he was partying or anything else the night before because he passed the field sobriety test. So there's no drugs, no alcohol in the system. So explain to me how it is you fell asleep. And you fell asleep, you know, you dozed off for as long as you did. And you didn't sort of wake up until
after you hit a pole?
No, until recruits are bouncing off his window. That's what he just said. So I mean, you know, everybody's been there in terms of, like, you're doing a long drive, a cross-country drive or something. It's night, and you start to doze off, and you catch yourself because you're aware you're dozing off, right? It's a split second, normally. It's not like you collapse, like you go to sleep, and then it takes the force of, like, bodies bouncing off your car to awaken. But we didn't get that question.
No.
So we don't have that answer.
And we didn't, in the reporter too, because I watched, you know, the preview of it, and then I watched the piece when it aired last week. She didn't even ask him to, how do you feel about police? Do you support police?
Well,
or are
that
you
was,
part of the defund police group?
Yeah, that was discussed. That was discussed in this interview in terms of the family's connection to law enforcement,
right,
and that there's no antagonism to law enforcement here.
He doesn't have anything against officers. We have a whole family that's that are officers.
Two brothers that are retired California Highway Patrol. I've got two cousins that are LA County Sheriffs, one retired, one still active. And I've got another cousin who is a LAPD retired detective, and myself, the Department of Corrections.
You know, the dad and the kid appear perfectly nice, you know, perfectly stable, perfectly thoughtful in this interview, which in part I think was designed to present them in that light, but nonetheless, they do. So I'm not ascribing, I mean, you know, certainly not disputing the fact that they have a law enforcement connection. The family does, okay.
But and how maybe, does he feel about them?
Well, he expressed remorse. This was a sort of closing statement in the interview.
I didn't intentionally do it. I wish it never happened. I feel essentially like I feel bad it happened.
So that's not a guy who's, you know, a defund the police ideologue. Certainly doesn't sound like it. And based on the information that's been provided, he hasn't previously been in trouble with the law. He obviously, he's working as an electrician, so he's got a job. And family seems nice. So, and they're broken up about it. So it's difficult to discern. I'm not saying that the family is running any kind of scam here, but I just don't understand. I mean, you know, if he had a medical condition, or if there's evidence there was a medical incident, like he blacked out,
or
like
he had somebody, a seizure,
like, yeah,
or,
seizure, yeah. You faint, something like that. Okay, then maybe I understand it. But I mean, when you see that video, first of all, he's falling asleep. He's going 40 miles an hour, and he's got a pretty long run up until he gets to those recruits and plows into them. And I just, again, why were you so tired? Do you normally fall asleep at 6:30 in the morning when you're going to work? So how did it happen that day, do you think? I just like to get a better sense. I don't want to, you know, I'm open mind. You want to be open-minded on this, but it just doesn't. I fell asleep. I woke up. Bodies are bouncing off my car.
And then I hit a pole. But the biggest point of contention I have with this story is then toward the end of the report, he claims that he's a victim. He said, you know, police inflicted the wounds that you see on his face.
Well,
that's what his attorney said.
The attorney intervened when that question was asked.
This was when
I don't think that we're going to talk
You're
about
go that. Down that.
No.
Was it the airbag?
No.
That went off? It wasn't the accident.
No.
Nicholas did not want to discuss his injuries, nor did his attorney.
He's got some scratches on his face, right, and, you know, fat lip and this and that. So, right. So with the attorney there, you're almost setting up, and that would take some real stones if they filed some sort of police brutality case against the LA County Sheriff's Department. But, you have an attorney there.
Yep.
And the guy should have an attorney because, again, to be one other point that's important here, it's still an ongoing investigation. So there's still the possibility of some criminal charges, even if the conclusion is that this was unintentional. And that's basically what the dad reported that a homicide detective told him.
One of the homicide detectives, he's the one that called me yesterday and said, you know, after speaking with his coworkers and your neighbors and some investigation, he says, we just don't see your son actually doing this intentionally, and my partner is filing the paperwork to have him released.
Okay, well, so even if you stipulate that it wasn't intentional, you know, it doesn't have to be intentional to be charged with a lesser crime than, say, attempted murder. You know, particularly if you have that Alejandro Martinez, if he doesn't make it. But I just want to know a little bit more. I want a little bit more color on that morning from Nicholas Gutierrez than we got in that interview. I left unsatisfied.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Vince, St. Charles, here in Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, you know, there's a report in Des Plaines that the guy dozed off because of medical and he swerved. A friend of mine dozed off, he swerved. I don't buy it. When you fall asleep for some medical condition, you don't streamline, like you say, 40 miles an hour directly to people or to direct in a direct line. I don't buy it. I mean, I heard the interview. I don't buy it. Something's fishy. And you're calling it, Dan. You're talking about it. I do not buy it. There's something wrong with this story.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Appreciate it. Well, the other thing, too. Okay, so, Nicholas, so you woke up when bodies were bouncing off your car. That's your story. So then how come you didn't brake? There's no evidence he
no
pressed the brakes. So how you were what, in shock until you hit the pole? Even as you, I mean, you wake up and bodies are bouncing off your car. What's your reflex action? I would think it would be to brake. So again, I'm not saying it's intentional. There's contrition. There's regret. There's not really any evidence that there's any antagonism towards police here, but it does seem like maybe there was some negligent or reckless conduct, and he's trying to cover it up with the "I fell asleep, so I'm not culpable," or "I had a medical." He's not saying I'm medical incident. He said
no
"I fell asleep." Again, just a simple question. You're going to work at 6:30 in the morning. Putatively, you just got up. And
right,
so how are you so tired?
That reporter did a horrible job on that interview. Ugh.
John in
so
Crown Point.
Hi, Dan and Amy. I love your show. Love Amy more.
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
you
the
get
reason
that
I listen
order,
to
right?
Yeah,
no.
I know.
All right. Go ahead, John. I'm sorry.
The reason I listen to you guys is it keeps me awake when I go to work. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Very good. Keep the hands at 10 and 2 and the eyes forward. Thanks for the call, John. Something else, too, just in terms of California. I mean, we are talking about L.A. We are talking about California here. Just as an aside, since we're talking about law and order. Mm-hmm. Did you see this Daily Mail report? The Daily Mail reports more than 7,000 sex offenders convicted of lewd or lascivious acts with a child under 14 years of age received a year or less of prison time. 7,000 sex offenders, lewd or lascivious acts, kid under 14, a year or less in California.
Mm-hmm. Disgusting. That's the normalization of pedophilia. Right there.
It's right. The things that don't make sense, they just keep multiplying. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today. 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday, Maricopa County and Mojave County certified the election results from November 8th. But not without incident, particularly the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors meeting, as well as the Board of Supervisors meeting in Mojave. There was an interesting statement made by the board chairman there. Cochise County, which is a Republican county, you know, Republican dominated, refused to certify the election, even though they're, as I understand it, sort of they're under state legal mandate to do so. But this is just the beginning, says Carrie Lake. Carrie Lake posted this to her Twitter, an update on what's transpired as of yesterday and what is to come. Take a listen.
We will file this case in accordance with Arizona state law, and you'll want to stay tuned for this one. Trust me. So many have expressed concern about Maricopa County's certification. I agree. This botched election should not be certified, especially in Maricopa County, where the Board of Supervisors are well aware of the catastrophic issues caused by maladministration of Supervisor Bill Gates and County Recorder Stephen Richer, who started a dark money PAC with the sole purpose of going after me, my campaign, and our movement while they supervise the election. My case, our case, moves forward with these sham certifications. In fact, state statute requires certification before our case can move forward.
You know, so these things are a process and they can be protracted, right, as I think most people have become aware of over the last several years. But you're hearing from Carrie Lake that she is going to pursue a challenge now that the results have been certified.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. As she should, I support her 100% because I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but there is something seriously wrong, and there's been something wrong with Arizona elections for decades. And it's just recently in the past 4 or 5 years, it's made the national stage, but living there too, even, you know, the mayoral race in Tucson when I was down there was fraught with danger. I mean, it was just it's so messed up. And the fact that Katie Hobbs, I don't even want to say her name, is in charge of her own election. She should have recused herself and she should have let somebody else be in charge because it's wrong.
Actually, I don't agree with that. I know this is an argument that's being made by Carrie Lake and others. I don't think Brian Kemp needed to recuse himself when he was Secretary of State running for governor. I don't think George Ryan or Jim Edgar needed to recuse themselves in Illinois. They're not operating the election. The most of the frontline personnel stay as the elected officials come and go. And yes, you could say, well, they do have loyalists that are in positions of authority and so forth. I understand, but you know, there are real penalties for committing large-scale fraud. And so, you know, if it's the left who wants it both ways, it was a problem with Kemp and it's not a problem for Hobbs. I want to be consistent here. I don't think it was a problem for Kemp, and I don't think it's intrinsically a problem for Hobbs either, or a Secretary of State anywhere running for governor. And I use a couple of recent examples in Illinois. But that doesn't mean there are not other problems, particularly in Maricopa County, because there are. Something else, though, too, before we even get to Maricopa and some of the comments at that raucous board meeting, Mojave County, the Board of Supervisors there certifying the election, Ron Gould, who's on the Board of Supervisors there, had this to say in advance of the vote to certify.
I vote aye under duress. I found out today that I have no choice but to vote aye or I'll be arrested and charged with a felony. I don't think that is what our founders had in mind when they used the democratic process to elect our leaders, our form of self-government. And I find that very disheartening. With your vote of 4 ayes and 0 nays, you've approved item 1B. Anything else for the good of the order? We're adjourned.
Voting aye under duress. I mean, you know,
I'll be arrested and charged with a felony?
Well, the state law is state law.
Right.
And I don't know the particulars of it, but and you heard Carrie Lake, too. You need the certification to actually move forward with the election challenge. That's the process set up. If you don't like the process, then you should move to change the law. And frankly, this has been a failure of Doug Ducey, the previous governor, or the outgoing governor, and the legislature in Arizona. Probably should have spent less time litigating the 2020 election and more time moving legislation through the General Assembly to get signed by Doug Ducey in advance of the 2022 election. At the Maricopa County Board meeting, this gives you a little bit of a flavor of some of the commentary that was offered by residents of Maricopa County. This is a guy who is from some outlet called Real America's Voice. He says he spends most of his time documenting issues at the border and the cartels, the drug cartels' incursion into Arizona. But here was his comment about the election results and said certification.
What we saw on Election Day was outrageous. And to say that it was anything but that is either you think we're stupid or you're just that arrogant. What we've seen from you in the election office and your response, very simple questions needed to be asked. 2020 was a disaster. How was 2022 worse? You cannot say that you can certify an election when half of the voting machines were down. Was it 1,000 people that were disenfranchised? Was it 10,000 of the people that were there in line or the people that didn't show up because they saw on the news the election machines didn't work? The fact that you've already made up your minds, you've already made the decision. This is all semantics. All of us coming up here and speaking is semantics. You've already made your vote. You've already made this decision. You said the world is watching and you're right. They're watching and they're watching this disaster play out in front of them. You responded to the AG with the most pathetic, inept response I've ever seen. You have not redressed the grievances of these people. That is the question. And the answer that I hear from everyone across this room is you cannot certify. So the question is, what is the remedy? The fact that you were on a pack that was going against Carrie Lake as well as Richer, going against Carrie Lake, how can you say that there's no conflict of interest? You have a Secretary of State running against a gubernatorial candidate. How can you say there's no conflict of interest? And then your machines go down on Election Day. It is absolutely outrageous. If you certify today, the only thing you'll be certifying is your corruption.
Thank you again.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. The more concerning conflict of interest for me, I mean, people may disagree, obviously they do, with respect to Hobbs and being Secretary of State, overseeing the election, technically, I doubt literally. The county recorder, Stephen Richer, that was mentioned by that gentleman you just heard from, he was mentioned, and it was mentioned by Carrie Lake, too. Stephen Richer is the Maricopa County Recorder, and he was involved with a independent expenditure pack, as I understand it, opposing Carrie Lake.
Oh, come on.
Now that starts to get into a little bit more of a conflict of interest, particularly when he is the guy who is addressing audience concerns, explaining the ballot and signature verification process. And so he was apparently writing point on that. The county recorder apparently does in Maricopa County because he was the guy providing the explanations, you know, with that Bill Gates goofball in addition to him. But if you're operating a pack now, I mean, think about it this way. Do you think that Governor Pritzker would have a problem if I, running an independent expenditure pack opposing his election, was the person in charge of verifying the processes and vote totals in DuPage County? You think they'd raise any issues?
Out of his mind. I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, there were 67 polling locations where there was a technical glitch, so people couldn't put their ballots to be tabulated on site, and instead they had to put it in this box to be taken to election headquarters.
Door three.
But I'm saying that people don't feel secure about that. And then some people were so intimidated by that, they didn't even go and vote.
Well, this is the point, too. You know, for all the talk of voter suppression, here's another thought exercise. If this had happened in majority black precincts in, you know, pick your state or community, but in a closely contested race. Oh, do you think there would be any calls from the Stacey Abramses of the world and the entire D.C. press corps and all the race hustlers of voter suppression?
They'd be out of their mind. I mean, it would be the lead on the news. This is like buried.
They treat voter ID, having to present voter ID, as voter suppression. But if they were machines weren't working at polling places with a majority of black voters, and there was reports that the machines aren't working and the lines are too long and the lines are 3 hours long and so on and so forth. Is that voter suppression in any way? Would that be treated as voter suppression by the left? Of course it would.
Yes, it would be.
Of course it would.
I mean, think about it. 67 locations, you couldn't tabulate your vote on site.
And the whole sort of cover story from Maricopa County election officials is,
it happens.
We got through it. Everything was verified. Everything was fine. And everything was counted properly and so on and so forth. Right. But you, because of the performance in 2020, you have decimated people's confidence, particularly conservative people's confidence in your ability to administer free and fair elections. And so, you know, it's impossible to quantify. But just logically, do you think some people hear everything that's going on or have this experience at the polling place and through word of mouth it spreads and that has some voters throw up their hands and say, oh, the hell with it?
They started having problems at 6:30 in the morning. Guys, I mean, give me a break. And what was the chain of custody before going from that polling place to the election board where they were being counted?
Well, that's one of the questions that Carrie Lake's challenge should seek to answer.
Yeah.
Mike in Plano, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, you know, if the legislature passed something over the last 2 years, who's to say Doug Ducey would have even signed it? Because even though he wasn't open about it, he was never Trump. He was part of that, you know, McCain faction that's been running that state out there forever. And they're all about big business, big real estate. They don't really care too much about Republican base issues. So they only care about money and power. So they had no problem colluding with the progressive leftists to let her take the governorship to prevent an outsider populist like Lake from winning. They figure, hey, Katie Hobbs, she's got a Republican state legislature. She's not going to be able to do much. And I saw a statement from her the other day where she was even criticizing Biden's handling of the border. So she's already pivoting to the middle. So she knows she can't really – she doesn't have much of a mandate out there. But
yeah, she'll be a Sinema, a Kristen Sinema knockoff, right, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. My biggest concern is how do Republicans win election out there at the presidential level, regardless of if it's Trump or anyone else, even if DeSantis ran on a populist platform, as long as those same people are in charge.
Thanks for the call, Mike. Well, that's a fair question. Bill, LaSalle County. Hey, Bill.
Bill.
Good morning. Hey, Dan. If you remember, I called on Election Day about the election machines, counting machines not working at my polling station in LaSalle County. And you had indicated to call the clerk. Well, I did, and they told me that all the machines in LaSalle County were down the first hour of that day. So basically everybody had to drop their ballots in box number 3. So I just wonder, you know, you got to wonder if there's any shenanigans going on there also.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. Thanks for the call, Bill, that all the machines in LaSalle County were down for the first hour. Yeah, I mean, you know, this also goes back to the relationship between elected officials and their constituents. I mean, I can't help but go back to my experience at the Iowa caucus back in 2012. And watching a caucus take place,
awesome, isn't it?
At a school in Des Moines, where I'll just briefly repeat it, where get up. Okay, anybody here to speak for Mitt Romney? Anybody here to speak for Barack Obama? And on down the line, and get up and people want to speak for the candidates they support, give their pitch for a couple of minutes. And then,
shoebox.
Everybody gets like a little shard of paper and just write down your choice. And then literally a woman came around with a FootJoy golf shoe box and you just threw your shard of paper in the golf shoe box. And then she said, okay, we're going to go count the votes in the back here. If anybody wants to watch, you're welcome to count. You're welcome to come back and watch us count. Nobody came back. Yeah, zero people came back.
Yeah.
Trust between elected officials and constituents, and the complete absence, justifiably, the complete absence of trust in places like Illinois or Arizona, where you have ruling political elites who lord over their constituents, particularly if you're in the minority, as Republicans are now, as Republicans are in Illinois, and are increasingly so in Arizona. So this is why it's so much a state and local matter. And it should be, because Iowa should be a model that other states replicate. But if you want to live in a kleptocracy, a cacistocic kleptocracy, if you want to be ruled by, well, lorded over by your lessers, then you can choose that in Illinois, as we have. And if you want to have common sense leadership and be neighborly in the process, then you can choose that and you can move to Iowa. That's it. 50 laboratories. Margo in Burr Ridge.
Yeah, I don't know when they decided that the signature thing was so important, but I, you know, in verifying that you're there to vote. But it must have been before we had photo IDs. I can tell you, because I've been election judge now a few times, that is a fantasy. The signatures never match, never. And, I mean, the person signed it years ago, their driver's license, whatever it is. We made a lot of people show their photo ID because their signatures did not match. Mm-hmm. Now, this curing business, when the person's not even there and you can't ask for a photo ID, that is ridiculous, and they need to stop that. You need to be voting with a photo ID and forget the whole signature thing, because none of us are trained, whatever you call the people who check signatures and writing and all of that. They need to go by the photo ID. We now have that technology, which we probably didn't have when they started with the whole signature business. So that's my thing.
Thanks for the call, Margo. Well, you know, and you had DuPage County, the case that was enjoined with there were the improperly counting, processing absentee ballots. They were improperly verifying signature based on application rather than based on the signature on the application rather than the signature on the voter card. So, I mean, if you were committing fraud, you sign.
Easy way to do it.
You sign the application and you sign the envelope that you send back the ballot in. Well, that's what kind of verification is that if there's fraud going on? And so this is why the DuPage County Circuit Court judge said that's a process that is, number one, violative of the law. Number two, provides opportunity for fraud. And so it was enjoined. It's happening in DuPage County. Well, I mean, listen to what Margo's saying in Burr Ridge. Chris and Carrie.
Hey, Dan, I thought you might find it interesting, and I don't know, maybe it's just a conspiracy theorist to me, but I received three of your McHenry Times, quote-unquote, fake newspapers after the election, but they were all dated. The date in the corner was pre-election, but I just thought It was curious why I'd receive those after the election. And I wasn't the only one. A couple of my neighbors did too.
Yeah.
Have you heard that before, Dan?
Thanks for the call. Yeah, we've gotten a lot of that. So, or heard a lot of that. Not my papers, by the way. But yes. So some of that happens because of volume. And, you know, those are newspapers, so they're not red tagged as political mail, which gets priority, you know, because obviously the post office, it indicates to the post office these are on deadline. They have to get there before election day. But even that doesn't always happen. So sometimes it's just, to be generous, the post office is overwhelmed. Maybe it's a competence or efficiency issue. And sometimes it's something else. Sometimes because there are post offices in Illinois that are notoriously political and will slow walk Republican stuff. So that is actually being looked into. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris from Cary, because in some places it could just be a volume competence issue. In other places, there may have been some purposeful slow walking because of all the notoriety per Pritzker and the press corps associated with those papers. So we are actually looking into that to sort of separate who failed and for what reasons and seek remedies if we think people acted maliciously At the post office. So that is being pursued. Appreciate the call. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, are you watching the protests going on in China? The white paper protests, have you seen those? The effort by the Chi Coms to squash any videos of the protesters on their heavily censored social media sites by pushing into those same sites all these porn bots. In the coverage of that. Interesting what's happening in China. Does it go anywhere? Does it lead to the toppling of the Xi regime, the Chinese communists? Doubtful. But it's nonetheless worth taking note of, isn't it? In part because it offers a mirror test for the West. How are we doing in response? Well, yesterday at a White House press briefing, National Security Council spokesman John Kirby was present to answer questions about our relationship with Chinese communists and Venezuelan communists. He was asked by Phil Wegman if there was any message from the White House to those protesting President Xi and the Chinese communists, and this is what he said.
I'm wondering, what is the president's reaction when he hears protesters in China chant freedom or Xi Jinping step down?
The president's not going to speak for protesters around the world. They're speaking for themselves.
So there's no reaction?
These protesters are speaking for themselves. What we are doing is making it clear that we support the right of peaceful protest.
Well, that's heroic. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline, 64636DA, turnkey.protextline. Now, follow up, Mr. Kirby. I didn't ask you to speak for the protesters. I asked you what the president's reaction to what the protesters are saying and doing is. That's what I asked.
And Kirby didn't criticize China's government or what they're doing. I mean, 10 people died because they were locked in their apartment building and there was a fire and they couldn't get out. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Did you see the picture? I tweeted it out too. They're welding doors shut in apartment buildings and putting up, you know, a pipe to make sure that they can't get out because he has a zero COVID policy, which is ridiculous.
Well, the COVIDians leader, Tony Fauci, was on with Jake Tapper on CNN.
Is this on his exit interviews, we hope?
And he was asked about what's happening in China. And to your point about welding people in and so on and so forth, the protesters chanting freedom. Tony Fauci, again, leader of all of the COVIDians, which is basically the left in this country. What did he have to say about those abuses? What did he have to say about the protesters? Well, you know, it really matters. You have to look at it through what's trying to be accomplished here. Listen to Tony Fauci. If you thought John Kirby was offering weak tea, listen to Fauci.
Well, when you want to shut down in order to interrupt immediately a process that's going on like the spread of infection, there should be a purpose to it. Like you want to make sure you get enough ventilators or enough PPE, or you want to get your population vaccinated. The comment that I made about their severe actions that they've taken is that you have to have an end game. What's the purpose? If the purpose is let's get all the people vaccinated, particularly the elderly, then okay for a temporary period of time to do that. But they have very, very strict type of a lockdown. They're locking people in their homes, which is really they can't even go out and, from what I hear, shop or walk a dog or something like that. That's going to create a lot of pushback on the part of the population if there's no underlying purpose of what you want to do.
Wow. 312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. You can always text us at 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
Right. So you understand now. You know, if you can, you can weld people into their homes if you're trying to get them vaccinated.
I mean, what is he even talking about?
You know, it's something else, too. If I, you know, can't even go out shopping, walking the dog.
People are
starving. That reminds me of someplace else during the pandemic.
Yeah.
Where was that?
Yeah.
The Western world?
Yeah. San Francisco, remember that? They locked people in. And only one person in the house could walk the animal at a time. I mean, think what they did to us. We weren't far away from this, guys. But people forget. Now, like, oh, you know, yeah, but we had to do what we had to do. No, we didn't. And they're telling Americans that are living in China right now, the U.S. Embassy is saying stock up on food and water for at least a month. But some people have been locked in their homes for 4 months. Mm-hmm. Wow,
so,
Fauci didn't fight back at all for those people.
So those are the pronouncements. You know, sort of just generically, not applying it to the Chinese protesters or any other protesters, the Iranian protesters. Generally, we have this belief in the right to peacefully protest, and that's all we'll say about what's happening in China. That's John Kirby. And then Tony Fauci offers the most stern response he can generate is they're severe when they're welding people into their homes. That's severe, but if there's an underlying good, like getting people vaccinated, well, then these human rights abuses are okay for a temporary period.
Oh, you mean just 2 weeks?
Those are remarkable statements to me from representatives of our government. Aren't they? No? Oh, by the way, Tony Fauci, just on the topic of lying, which is really in part what this is. Tony Fauci recently was deposed in a lawsuit filed by several attorneys general, led by Missouri Attorney General Eric Schmidt. And he said that... during his seven-hour deposition with Fauci, new information revealed that 2 months after Fauci told a friend masks were ineffective, he supported mask mandates. He emailed a friend in February of 20 advising her masks were ineffective, confirmed again on March 31st. On April 3rd, he's adamant masks should be worn, even though he could not cite a single study to prove it. Then mandates followed. As Schmidt said, that's when COVID tyranny was born. February 20, emailed a friend advising her masks weren't effective. Confirmed that on March 31. 4 days later, he's adamant that masks should be worn. And so they were. Mandated.
Well, who got to him?
Anybody need to get to him? Yeah. Now, the contrast here is... Jimmy Lai is the imprisoned former publisher of the Apple Daily newspaper in Hong Kong and China. He is scheduled to go on trial, and this is a show trial. Three charges related to collusion with foreign forces, another involving conspiracy to publish and distribute seditious material, and... national security offenses. He could have pled guilty to try to secure a lighter sentence to perhaps get out of prison, certainly to save his life. But he won't. Not going to. He's made peace with the fact that he's not coming out. There, as Bill McGurn writes in a very good column in the Wall Street Journal, there is not a man, woman, or child in Hong Kong who doesn't believe the verdict is already in. The authorities are taking no chances either, having Jimmy Lai tried before three national security judges rather than a jury. So why doesn't he just plead out, admit his guilt? McGurn writes, lies have always been the foundation of communist authority. Communists also have a habit of insisting their victims embrace the lies. Probably most of us would agree to anything if it meant we might see our families again. So we shouldn't be too hard on those who give in. Jimmy actually is the first to forgive former friends and associates who've turned on him. Still, this should make us admire all the more those who refuse, and not only Jimmy, there are many others in jail in Hong Kong, alone and unknown, who are forcing their jailers to own the lie. He's in prison and at peace with his not guilty plea. It's his persecutors who are insecure and fearful. To get by under communism, a man must say one thing in private and something else in public. This sounded all familiar to what's happening in American culture, by the way. We talked about it a little bit yesterday. He references a Soviet dissident, Natin Sharansky, McGurn does in his piece. He was arrested and falsely accused of treason in 1977. He told an interviewer in 2013 about his experience in jail, if my aim is physical survival, then the KGB will defeat me. He aimed to instead live as a free person, which meant never, ever assenting to the lie. By insisting on his innocence, Jimmy Lai knows he has surrendered any hope for leniency. But he is showing that a man can live as a free person, even in a Chinese prison, as long as he refuses to lie. Hong Kong's communist-backed authorities have yet to realize that he's no longer really on trial. They are. Yeah. And as I said, so is the West. So are we in America. So is this administration. It's a mirror test. What grade would you give them? And if you think that this is only in these faraway dictatorships, I don't know how anybody thinks that anymore, but people do. Only in these faraway dictatorships. Nothing to do with what's happening in America. Listen to this exchange yesterday between some fungible member of the press corps and the quadruple threat, KJP, Karine Jean-Pierre, who continues to prove she is one of the dumbest people on the planet, but nonetheless a dutiful, useful idiot, just like the spokesbeings for totalitarian regimes from time immemorial.
Question about Twitter. There's a researcher at Stanford who says that this is a critical moment, really, in terms of ensuring that Twitter does not become a vector for misinformation. I mean, are you concerned about the, Elon Musk says there's more and more subscribers coming online. Are you concerned about that? And what tools do you have? Who is it at the White House that is really keeping track of this?
So, look, this is something that we're certainly keeping an eye on. And look, we have always been very clear and that when it comes to social media platforms, it is their responsibility to make sure that when it comes to misinformation, when it comes to the hate that we're seeing, that they take action, that they continue to take action. Again, we're all keeping a close eye on this. We're all monitoring what's currently occurring. And we see it with our own eyes of what you all are reporting and just for ourselves, what's happening on Twitter. But again, social media companies have a responsibility to prevent their platforms from being used by any user to incite violence, especially violence directed at individual communities, as we have been seeing. And the president has been very clear on calling that out. He'll continue to do that. And we're going to continue to monitor the situation. Go ahead.
Thanks, Greenberg.
Apple Daily in Hong Kong, Twitter in America, continuing to monitor the situation. She asked a vector for misinformation. Vector. You're trying to sound intelligent. And also, characterizing it the way that that viruses are characterized a vector for transmission. That's what this is. Misinformation is a virus. Mm. Misinformation is also synonymous with hate based on Karine Jean-Pierre's response. It's interesting because the UN recently tweeted this out. Words can be weapons. Hate speech online can lead to cruelty and violence in real life. Get tips for how you can say hashtag no to hate. Oh, the Chi-Coms have some tips. Yeah, they've got some tips. Put people who say things with which you disagree, who are critical of those in power, in prison.
And they're sending, this morning, they're sending students at universities home because they'll think, you know, they'll be less likely to protest and gather. Let alone stopping people on the streets and checking their social media to see if they tweeted recently about any of the protests. That's what they're doing this morning.
Living a different life in public than you do in private. We've visited this topic many times. For those listening and thinking about those people in your circles of influence, how many are doing that in this country right now? Living a different life in public than they do in private, out of fear. So you tell me how qualitatively different it really is. Obviously, we're not down the road to gulags quite yet, or we're not to that part in the road. But this is the beginning. Is that overwrought? Is that hysterical? Is that not proportionate to what's happening? I don't know. I don't know. But I know something else that people who do know have observations that are relevant for us. When he received the Templeton Prize, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, who, of course, spent many decades in Russian gulags, said this: more than half a century ago, while I was still a child, I recall hearing a number of older people offering the following explanation for the great disasters that had befallen Russia. Quote, men have forgotten God, that's why all this happened. Since then, I spent well nigh 50 years working on the history of our revolution. In the process, I've read hundreds of books, collected hundreds of personal testimonies, and have already contributed 8 volumes of my own toward the effort of clearing away the rubble left by that upheaval. But if I were asked today to formulate as concisely as possible the main cause of the ruinous revolution that swallowed up some 60 million of our people, I could not have put it more succinctly than to repeat, men have forgotten God, that's why all this happened. In Russia, in China, but the U.S. is immune. If you think so, just again, ask yourself that question. Are you and people you know living different lives in public versus in private out of fear? And think of the Jimmy Lai example. And try and emulate it as best you can, I'd suggest.
This is The Morning Show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. As you've been hearing the last couple of weeks, we've kicked off our Food for the Poor campaign this holiday season, and we appreciate all the support we've gotten so far and hope to generate more in advance of our goal of feeding 1,300 families of four who need to be fed for the next year because they just don't have stable access to food. We're talking about in some of the poorest countries in the world, in Central America. That's our focus. And nobody who is able to better explain this, the importance of what Food for the Poor does, how they do it, and how your charity goes to work to keep people around the world alive, than Todd Chapman. He is the Director of Cause and Ministry and Development at Dunham Share Media. Todd, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, my pleasure. Always good to be back in Chicagoland. I spent some time here on the way back, so it always feels like coming home.
Yeah, a lot of people say that. I used to live in Chicago. So, Todd, tell us about this year's campaign and compare and contrast it from the program last year.
Well, you know, it's we're still inviting listeners to be a part of our foundational work at Food for the Poor, which is feeding starving families. We've been doing that in 17 countries for more than 40 years now. But the thing, I guess, that's different, Dan, and this is going to be quite a statement because, you know, we're kind of all in, we're emerging from COVID mode, right? But in the countries where we serve, the effects and the after effects of COVID are still being profoundly felt. As a matter of fact, in all 17 countries where Food for the Poor works, we have never had a greater need for food than we have right now because, you know, supply chain issues continue to be a thing there. Inflation has driven the food prices up, not only for us, but imagine if you're in a, you know, one of these poor countries making $2 or $3 a day and the price of rice and beans, every food product goes up. It really does throw these already poor families to the point of desperation and starvation. And actually, that's a global trend. If you look at the world statistics, the global statistics, the World Food Program says that there's about 100 million more people this year on the brink of starvation globally than there were last year. And so this continues to be a huge issue. But Food for the Poor, you know, just as we have for 40 years, we're battling this on the front lines with our church partners. We're a faith-based organization. And we work with church partners of all denominations in all 17 countries. We find out where the greatest needs are. And thanks to generous listeners like here on WIND, we take your gifts and we turn it into food for starving children with great efficiency, I might add.
You know, that just on that issue of what COVID and the response to COVID has done to increase the number of people that are facing starvation.
Yeah.
That's exactly what David Beasley, the executive director of the UN's World Food Program, said would happen when when the West started to lock down. He pleaded with the West, don't lock down.
Yeah.
We're not going to be able to get food to people who need it. And you're suggesting that what he said would happen has happened.
Yeah, I was actually on a conference call back at the beginning of COVID with leaders from some of the biggest NGOs around the world. And one of the spokespeople actually made a heart-stopping statement that turned out to be true. He said that COVID-19 and everything that it will bring with it will rewind, his words, rewind the poverty clock 20 years. Because, you know, over the last 20, 25 years, all of these NGOs around the country, around the world rather, thanks to, in large part, generosity of Americans, have made significant progress in battling starvation, illness, you know, a lack of clean water. But COVID really it decimated all of that work. So we're playing catch up right now. But I'm really pleased to say that as I've continued to travel around the country during 2022 and just let people know that, hey, this is a thing, it's a need, people have stepped up and have responded with great generosity and provided a lot of food for starving children. But the need is still there. And so we're just counting on the 560 The Answer family to step forward and be as generous as you can. And by the way, Giving Tuesday today, so I have an incredibly special offer. Can I put that out there?
Yeah,
please.
Let's go. Well,
I should
also
say opportunity,
people, 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor is where you can go to make a donation.
Yeah, there's a big red banner there at 560 The Answer. Just, it says give food. You can click on that, make your gift. Every gift being given today is tripled on Giving Tuesday. Very generous friend. We'll take whatever you do, times it by three, and so a gift of $72, which would normally feed one child for the next year through one of our feeding programs. Today it's actually feeding three kids. If you could give a gift of $144, get the six kids eating for the next year. And our feeding programs, typically two meals a day for these kids in need, 5 days a week. So you can imagine these kids are going Amy, you've seen it. You traveled with me to Haiti.
I know.
These kids are going days without eating anything of substance. And so you can imagine what a lifeline this is when you give your gift and you allow us to get these kids into the programs. You stop the malnutrition. You stop the food insecurity. You know, in Guatemala, for example, child stuntedness is a huge issue. Kids actually stop growing because they just don't have enough food. It's so tragic.
And to go back to the COVID, you know, a lot of them got that one meal at school.
Yeah,
and
schools
were shut down. For years.
Yeah, well over a year. Some schools in some countries still not opening. And, of course, a lot of people lost jobs, and those jobs have not come back. And so, you know, with employment, in huge decline right now, that has an impact. You know, I mean, no safety nets here in the U.S. We have fallback systems. We've got safety nets. They don't have any of that.
None of that.
Yeah, the safety net is the generosity
of
people like you.
Food for the Poor helps with immunizations, with shots, with medical care. Talk about that aspect.
Yeah, so we're more than food. We build homes. We provide clean water solutions. We do skills training, medical care. And so we've been very involved in just getting as many vaccines and medical care in as many countries as we can to make a difference. And so, you know, we're doing everything we can to just hold the negative, effects and ramifications of COVID back. But we can't do it on our own. It's really, you know, we're a private charity. We're privately funded or publicly funded, I should say, just by people like you. We don't get government grants or anything like that. So we're really dependent upon people like you who just out of the goodness of your heart will say, you know what, that's not right that any child should go a single day without food. And if I can make a difference, I'm going to do that.
And because you've been doing this for so long and have accomplished so much, you brought this to scale in so many places. Mm-hmm. You actually have supply chains that nobody else does to provide these resources to these families.
Yeah, you know, 40 years of doing this, we've forged amazing partnerships. We've found favor with so many governments, and so we've minimized every expense. No import tariffs. You know, we've waded through all of the challenges, the logistical challenges that exist in these third world countries oftentimes. And and that's, you know, that's a big thing for us. Integrity and credibility. When you give to food to the poor, you can trust that your gift is going to make a difference. It's not being soaked up by huge administrative costs. For more than 40 years now, we've operated right in the realm of a 95% efficiency ratio. So in other words, 95% of all the gifts that come in typically go right back out to, you know, to feed these starving kids.
The Business Benefactor Program is something that we emphasize every year when we partner with you to help you do the great work that you do. And it seems to me that that's always a key, right? You need the donor leadership from the business community. And, you know, we try to sweeten the pot a little bit by trading some advertising time for donations from the business benefactors. Mm-hmm. But just speak a little bit to the business community specifically, those successful entrepreneurs, and how integral they are into meeting your goals.
Yeah, you know, it's really vital. As a matter of fact, I was just looking this morning at the kind of the tote board, if you will, the tally board, and we've already had six Chicagoland businesses step forward and join that business benefactor program this year with that gift of $2,500. So you give a gift of $2,500, all of it goes to Food for the Poor, and then AM560 will very generously provide you with an advertising schedule. And the thing that I think is a great testimony that it works is, and I don't know what the numbers are, but I know from looking at the list of businesses that have been a part of this over the last, how many years have we been doing this, 5 or 6 years now?
Yes.
Yeah, so many people come back year after year, and so that tells you that it works. And if you own a business or are in a position of leadership at a business where you control the checkbook to a certain extent and you're looking for a way to make a difference in the world and also benefit your business and getting some advertising on a great radio station, would strongly encourage you to do that.
Yeah, call Ann Jeanette Natowski at 847-472-8951. Again, that number, 847-472-8951, or simply go online to 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor. Now, you and I were talking because we spent time together in Haiti.
Yeah.
I know it's one of your 17 countries, but can you briefly tell us what's going on in that country? Because the president was assassinated, and then all heck broke loose.
Yeah, so candidly, Haiti is a country that's in extreme turmoil. You know, it's already been for a long time the poorest country on this side of the world. It continues to deteriorate, you know, if that's even possible. There's a lot of gang activity there right now. And just, you know, frankly, Food for the Poor, we are the largest nonprofit, the largest NGO still at work in Haiti. Many others have just said
it's too risky.
It's too hard. We can't be here. But Food for the Poor, we've got nationals. We've got, you know, nationals that work for us there. And so we're able to go in and get the work done. And I'm not going to say it's not challenging. It certainly is. But you know what? We're committed. We've been in Haiti for, I think, 35 years now. We're committed to staying there and helping the people of Haiti. It's an incredible country. You know, I've come to love the people of Haiti. My heart breaks for what's going on there because so many innocent families and children are being victimized by these insurrections and by the violence and the corruption. But, you know, what do? Do we walk away or do we stand up and continue to fight the fight and make a difference and hope and pray that it turns around? We believe that it will. And as long as, you know, God has us there and generous people continue to support our work there, we're going to continue to just help as many families as we can.
All right. Again, to make a gift of any amount, just call 844-862-4673 or visit 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor. And remember, it's 3X Day, so
yes.
Giving Tuesday, yeah. Every dollar turns into $3 because of donor, as Todd was explaining to us.
I was going to say, is that a shirt size? Is that a comment on my weight?
No. 3X?
No, you're still in shape. But again, no, talk about this, you know, this anonymous person who's going to triple your donation today. So if I give $100, it'll turn into $300 just like that.
Yeah, so we have a great partner that provides much of the food that we distribute through all 17 countries, and they just have tremendous resources and partnerships. And so they have actually said, hey, you know what? We've got an extra amount of food that we can add here on Giving Tuesday. So when you feed one child, they're going to actually feed two more children because they've just had just a, you know, it's a big, actually, it's they've got an office here in Chicago. And so they just have a lot of extra food available that we can ship. And, you know, there's a timestamp on that food. So this is a great opportunity to make a bigger difference. Three kids. You can feed three kids for a year for $72. I mean, we dropped $80 on our turkey, and it fed 17 people at our house almost one meal.
Right. With no leftovers.
With no leftovers. Well, there are a few leftovers.
And if you can't, make a donation on behalf of your well-fed children or grandchildren. Yeah. You know, I remember one time for my dad for Christmas, I made a donation on behalf of him in his honor.
For the person that's hard to buy for.
Exactly. Who doesn't, they don't want another t-shirt or a hat. They're decluttering. They don't want anything like that. But again, the number to call is 844-862-4673 or visit 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor.
And take advantage of Giving Tuesday and the tripling of your donation today. It'll get us a long way to our goal of 1,300 families of four being fed for a year via Food for the Poor. Todd Chatman, Director of Cause and Ministry Development at Dunham Share Media. Thanks as always, Todd. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30-plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. Out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, all things Illinois policy related, wirepoints.org. Before we get to that, I just have to comment on this comical op-ed from Jim Durkin's wife.
Oh, I just read it. Yeah.
Jim Durkin's wife rallying to his defense. Typical of like Western Springs, Hinsdale, where, women, p-hat women married to male impersonators. And Celeste Fisher, that's Jim Durkin's wife, Celeste Fisher, not Durkin, of course, is a good example of a p-hat. And Jim Durkin is a good example of a male impersonator. State Rep Jim Durkin is an endangered species. She writes, a socially moderate, fiscally conservative gentleman who plays well with others. Now, the reasonable dad of the Illinois Republican Party has had enough. He picked up his keys and he's going for a drive. As his wife, I'm happy for him and beyond proud. As a constituent, I'm at a loss. The mom in me wants to fold my arms, give the mom look to those who have made this mess and say, now look what you've done. What do you have to say for yourself, young man, young lady?
I mean, at the end, she wrote, Illinois Republican Party, you're in big trouble. I just can't look at you right now. Uh-huh. And while you sit up in your room, while your dad cools off, I really hope you think about what you've done.
Jim Durkin is my dad. He's the Illinois Republican Party's dad. Oh, well, apparently our dad is transitioning. While our nation watched in horror as the Capitol was stormed on January 6th, Jim publicly condemned the insurrectionists. Interesting choice of words, Miss Fisher, Jim Durkin's wife and mommy. Jim just wants to keep everyone safe. That consistently earned Jim a low grade from the NRA, a grade that could not make me love him more. Jim's mission has always been to grow the Republican Party, not diminish it. He took a stand and voted for the Equal Rights Amendment, supporting gender equality. These are the positions that earned him the title of Rhino, Republican in name only, from the far right, a pejority he is proud of, clearly. I think about Jim's U.S. Senate race against Senator Dick Durbin. That was gentlemanly and without lies and mudslinging, because this is what you call good sportsmanship. Remember that, says Mom. They distinguished themselves by focusing on facts and policy with the emphasis on the word distinguished. To this day, we're proud to call the senator from the other side of the aisle our friend because he's a good man. Dick Durbin.
We rode with Durbin to McCain's funeral and toasted our dear mutual friend.
That was nice of Jim Durkin to genuinely lose 60-40 in 2002. 2002, was that before Trump? How could a socially moderate, fiscally conservative dad like Jim Durkin lose to Dick Durbin? That was still where the Republican Party had some relevance even after the George Ryan debacle. What happened? Huh. Yeah. Yeah, and I'm sorry, Jim Durkin's tenure as House Republican Superminority Leader also predates Trump. So what happened? Celeste, Ms. Fisher? In fact, by the numbers, he is the most ineffectual House Republican leader in Illinois state history. He leaves the smallest caucus of either party in the General Assembly in Illinois history. So what happened?
What did he do?
Ms. Fisher? Well, a wonderful accomplishment, voting for the ERA, a pro-abort leftist propaganda tool for the better part of four decades. Being opposed to the NRA, right. That's made Illinois safer, hasn't it? Yeah. What have we done? Well, Jim Durkin got rid of himself. He took the stairs before he was shown the window. Not that the party is going to get any better under the current leadership in either chamber, because they still don't get it. But what they've done, all those who actually were in positions of authority over the past 20 years in the Illinois Republican Party, is made it smaller and smaller and smaller. And smaller. But you know what? As long as, obviously, a P-hat like Celeste Fisher is happy with the results, that's the important thing. As long as leftists in Tony suburbs are happy with the Republican Party, that's what's most important. Happy with their cuckolded partners. That's what's important. While they dine with Dick Durbin, who's a good man. If there's anything that Dick Durbin has demonstrated in his time in office in Illinois, it's that he's a good man. Mm-hmm. Starting to understand the things that I've been saying about Jim Durkin and about this party for those many 20 years. Mm-hmm. And yet, can't see our way fit to make a course correction. And so the direction will continue to be straight down until that happens. And then it's going to be a long climb back up because of how far we've driven ourselves down under the stewardship of male impersonators like Jim Durkin and P-hats like his pretend Republican wife. I don't even know what she's saying. She didn't say who she voted for, Durbin and Durkin. It sounds like it was a tough call for her. Oh, and she's part of the Stanford University novel writing program. That's her byline. Real impressive. Oh, man. I mean, you cannot make... They're cartoon characters. Cartoon characters. They are one-dimensional caricatures of human beings. People like Miss Fisher and the P-hat. Well, she's the P-hat. But, I mean, so is he. Male impersonator, we'll stick with that she married. You want to wade into the arena, Ms. Fisher? Welcome. Well, that's all partisan politics, so I don't want to bore Ted Dabrowski with that. But we do have some reflections that are in order. Ted, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Among those dearly departed Irish, not just Jim Durkin, not just Mike Madigan, not just John Cullerton, but now Ed Burke bids his fare thee well. No more Ed Burke.
He's been there since 1969, the year.
Glorious years. Ted, what was your favorite policy accomplishment of Ed Burke's?
I have no idea. You're gonna know that better than me. But you know what's fascinating, and for me, what's amazing is it's kind of like you go back to the Madigan ousting, right? So you know when Madigan was kicked out, the celebrations, things were going to get better. You know, not true, right? What we've seen is the deeply progressives come in and take over and push Illinois even further and faster, you know, down the wrong path.
One of the candidates running to replace Ed Burke is backed by Chuy Garcia. So that means she is a socialist, and that means things will get worse.
Exactly, because you know you've got five socialists on there. There's 11 openings on the aldermanic openings right now. So there's going to be a big push to get more of the same agenda. So you know, watch out what you wish for. And of course, nobody wants Ed Burke to be there anymore. That's not the point. The point is, what do you replace him with? And if you want to see Chicago continue its path faster and uglier and further down, then just watch this.
General Assembly is embarking on their veto session. How exciting. And there's a talk, you heard it on our newscasts, of some tweaks. Yeah, language cleanup and so on and so forth. Some tweaks to the Pritzker Purge Law. LaShawn Ford saying that he wants to advocate for clarity with respect to tickets versus arrests for trespassing. That was an issue. There's some talk about the threshold for either police to use force or for a person to be released, that the specific person test that's included in the purge law. And Kim Fox is saying that's language that we continue to talk about is being worked on. When we talked to you last week, you were pretty skeptical that we're going to see material changes to the Safety Act in terms of its impact. How do you feel today?
Yeah, I mean, for the record, Dan, maybe, this whole thing should be scrapped. And, we've said that from the beginning. And, as we've delved into it, across the board, it should be scrapped, started over, get the right people negotiating. And, bail and all that is tough stuff, right? And you always want to figure out how to minimize how much bail you use. But, on the other hand, bail is the best of the bad systems we have for maintaining our jails. So and public safety and then protecting the victims and all those things. But this group is not going to make any changes. I mean, they will do whatever tweaks. What they want to do is, Dan, you pointed out over and over and over again, all those small issues, quote, small in the language that make it so dangerous. Right. What are we going to do on January 1st with all these inmates or at least alleged criminals? What are we going to do, as we wrote this morning, about electronic monitoring and, giving people, quote, this time off, giving them some flexibility on their electric monitoring, every so often. There's so many pitfalls in the law that it should be scrapped. But I think what they'll do, Dan, is they'll try to just quiet people like you, like us, who complained about this thing.
I don't know.
Make sure.
Cosmetic
little
changes.
Things. No, but little things.
Yeah,
little
cosmetic.
Things.
Well, Cam Buckner, who, responsible for this legislation for the Safety Act. I mean, he said absolutely nothing is going to change in this bill. Mark my words.
So did the speaker. So did Chris Welch.
Yeah. And so, but they may get something. Again, it's all cosmetic. They won't do anything real. And they'll pretend. It'll all be pretend. The media will write about it and say that they made it better and clarified things and all that. But, yeah, forget it.
Well, don't you think, because Governor Pritzker, what I heard him saying multiple times is, no, January 1st, people aren't going to be let out of jail and run free. Hundreds of people aren't going to be running out. And like, yeah, it is, unless you change it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of confusion about what happens there. And I've talked to a couple of state's attorneys. One made it clear that he won't let people out because he doesn't want it to be on him. So you don't know how it plays out, but it certainly does create a lot of risk, and it creates a lot of legal risk for a whole bunch of people. So you know, for me, what's fascinating, I was looking at the data last night, you know, in Chicago, and, you know, we've got the Safety Act we're talking about. And if you look at 2022 versus 2021 in terms of year-to-date crimes, right, you would think that we're getting things under control, COVID is done, we're getting far away from George Floyd and all that. And it's hell no. You know, we're up 40% in the number of crimes this year over last year. And you're talking about car thefts up 93%, thefts up almost 60%, burglaries up 18%, overall crime 40%. And, you know, we're talking about 58,000 crimes this year compared to 41,000 crimes last year. How the hell we're doing something which diminishes public safety is surreal, right? It's just surreal.
On another score, I remember when we were fighting for 15, Ted. Remember those days many, what, months ago? Just a couple years ago. Fight for 15, $15 minimum wage. That's not going to work in an environment with 8% inflation. Let's kick it up to 25. What do you say?
25?
Yeah, I mean, can you imagine? Let's do it all across. Let's not just do it in Chicago. Let's do it across the state. So,
absolutely.
You know, a small diner in way down south can try to figure out how to manage that. No, you know, the SEIU, it's one of the most powerful unions in Illinois, Service Employees International Union. They want $25 an hour. Huh. And think about that. You know, before that came out, we wrote about how Illinois has not created a net, you know, overall net new jobs in 20 years. We've actually shrunk our total employment base by 156,000 jobs. So we've got the worst unemployment rate in the country, and yet here you go, you got this union saying we want more pay, $25. It's destructive. It's just a continuation of the same problem. And I tell you what's next, right? They raise that, and then with inflation, they're going to say, well, we also want price controls so that people can afford to pay for stuff. And
absolutely.
Then you're going to start moving into your Soviet economy.
Yeah, you know, we need rent controls, rent control in Chicago. Let's see, we need a property tax surcharge on homes worth more than $1 million for as long as they last at more than $1 million. There's not going to be very many left pretty soon. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I'm sure that the mayoral candidates and others will be peppered about this fight for 25 that SCU is launching, and who's going to oppose that? Certainly not Chuy Garcia.
Yeah.
I can't imagine Lori Lightfoot would.
Now, it's early days for this thing, but, you know, Crane's reported that something like, well, no candidates have said no to this idea. You know,
of course not.
Who said yes, but
got to keep an open mind.
Exactly.
You know who's going to love this? You know who's love this? I can't. You know who I want to hear from on this? Forget the politicians. They're useful idiots like Sam Sanchez, the chairman of the Illinois Restaurant Association. Hey, Sam, how's that going to be running your restaurants, La Luna and Moe's Cantina and others? How's that going to be running your restaurants in the city with a $25 minimum wage? How's that going to go well, you think? Or are you just going to work to get a carve out for your restaurants or just the restaurants? Or explain that to us. You know, I want to hear from the real policy leaders, all these sophisticated business elites that fly in formation with these tax eaters like SEIU.
Well, yeah, Daniel, it's a 60% hike, right? We're at $15 now. We'd go to 25. That's a 60% hike. Who knows how fast it happened? But think about what it would do to the price of a hamburger, the price of a couple eggs, the price of bacon.
Margarita's
right?
Going to be $60.
Stuff is already, it's already shooting up like crazy. Now, you can't go eat. If I go by myself now, I go to a diner. You can't get out with paying $20 if you get your, you know, couple eggs, bacon, hash browns, and your coffee. And you're with tip, you're at $20.
Yep.
And that's absurd. Now, imagine if they did this. That's why I say the next step would be price controls, because ordinary people can't afford that massive. So it would be, just shut down Chicago.
Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, the 2022 midterm election's behind us, so now we're looking forward to 2023 in the state of Illinois and our nation still facing significant challenges that can't be solved unless we remain vigilant. So mark this down. Thursday, December 8th at Bishop Hills Winery in Joliet. I want to invite you to join me along with Jeannie Ives and Stephanie Trussell for Uncorked Conversations, how the five biggest issues of 2023 will affect you and your family. It's presented by Range at 355. Again, it'll be me, Jeannie, Stephanie, several other ladies discussing the critical issues. It's an evening of fine wine and unfiltered conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, but mostly ladies, are invited to join us. Mark it down. Thursday, December 8th. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/uncorked. Seating is general admission and extremely limited, so get your tickets again today, 560theanswer.com/uncorked.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby had quite a day yesterday at the podium where he was documenting how we're underwriting one communist regime in South America while staying silent on the abuses of another communist regime in Asia. John Kirby responding to Peter Ducey's questions about the Biden-Maduro oil deal.
And on the sanctions relief for Venezuela,
yeah.
Why is it that President Biden would rather let U.S. companies drill for oil in Venezuela than here in the U.S.?
That's not an accurate take on the president's view.
Earlier this month, he said no more drilling. There is no more drilling.
The president has issued 9,000 permits for drilling on U.S. federal lands, Peter, 9,000 of them being unused. There are plenty of opportunities for oil and gas companies to drill here in the United States. I'll let Chevron speak for this particular issue of sanctions relief, but our expectation is it won't be a lot of oil coming out of there. It'll have to be shipped to the United States.
Does the president think there's some benefit to the climate to drill oil in Venezuela and not here?
No, it has nothing to do with a benefit to the climate, Peter. Again, there are 9,000 unused permits here in the United States on federal land that oil and gas companies can and should take advantage of. 9,000. And we're talking about one there in Venezuela. Now, look, it remains to be seen how much we'll get drilled down there. It'll be up to Chevron to decide that, Peter. But as a function of the sanction itself, that oil, whatever product is drilled, has to come to the United States.
Right. We'll pay Venezuela for it. Wonderful. Prop up Maduro. Makes sense. 9,000. Yeah, we've addressed that tire talking point back in the height of gas prices, how specious that is. But John Kirby and the administration are clinging to it, if you will. Charles Payne was on with Hannity last night responding to that propaganda you heard and giving his take on what's really at play here.
Why you would rather give this to a dictator? Do you know next month will mark, I think, the 23rd anniversary, 1999, when Venezuela voted for socialism. You know, they say you only can vote for socialism once, right? And it's gotten prohibitively worse. They used to produce 3 million barrels of oil a day. They're down to 700,000. They need America to come in there. They need Chevron to come in there. They need them to come in there with their tools and their expertise. It does nothing for America, to your point. This is dirty oil. And one other part of the story I don't think is getting enough attention. This administration has stopped Guyana, one of our key allies in the region, from getting a major grant, $180 million grant. They've got 11 billion barrels of proven oil, significantly cleaner than Venezuela. We won't give them the money because we won't fund fossil fuels, not only in this country, but even in small countries that are desperate for financial independence. We won't help them either.
But we will fund communist dictatorships. Back to Curry, when Phil Wegman queried him about the protests going on in China, the white paper protests, protesting President Xi's draconian lockdowns, COVID zero policies, human rights abuses. John Kirby had this to say about America's view.
I'm wondering, what is the president's reaction when he hears protesters in China chant freedom or Xi Jinping step down?
The president's not going to speak for protesters around the world. They're speaking for themselves.
So there's no reaction?
These protesters are speaking for themselves. What we are doing is making it clear that we support the right of peaceful protest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you weren't asked to speak for the protesters. You were asked what your view of the protesters is. But that's not forthcoming.
No, they didn't criticize China's government, what they're doing.
For more on all of this, Pleased to be joined by our friend Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
How about that two for yesterday?
You know, I think it's really depressing to hear Kirby say that stuff. Because there's a lot of people in the administration who are just, I mean, they're in over their head, and, you know, you say things, and they say things, and you kind of roll your eyes. But Kirby's a smart guy. He's smart enough to know that what he's saying is, like, unmitigated crap. And he's looking people in the eye and saying it to them. I mean, I realize that's the gig, but I don't know how you do that when you're a smart guy like him, and you know that, like, Maduro, the first thing would be, like, the United States doesn't even recognize Maduro as the leader of Venezuela, right? And the 9,000, I mean, he's smart enough to know that that's ridiculous. Like, they've done everything they could to make sure that it's not economically viable for the companies that he's calling on to exploit permits that have been issued. I mean, that's just it's a fact, and it would require like a first year of high school level understanding of economics to grasp that. And he knows that's ridiculous. So I just find it really depressing when you know that the people who are looking you in the eye and telling you this stuff are smart enough to know what they're saying is like completely false.
What
Very depressing.
What should have his statement been on the Chinese protests?
Well, you know, look, I'm the dyed-in-the-wool Reaganite on this one. I think that the model for how you treat something like this is what Reagan did during the Polish uprising in the 80s, where you make it clear to them that they have a friend and a supporter of liberty in the United States, and we call out evil for what it is. And I have to say, Amy, you know, if Trump were president and the Chinese had poured millions of dollars into the Trump family coffers, and then Trump spokesman went out and laid an egg when given a chance to champion the Chinese protest, the only story in America would be whether the Chinese had bought Trump.
Yeah, Manchurian candidate.
Let's say, you know, take Trump out of it and fill in the blank, any Republican. That would be the only story in America. And I've been saying for, you know, a couple of years now, I don't think the media and the Democrats want to turn the Hunter Biden, what they call the Hunter Biden story, into Hunter Biden and, it, you know, his personal failings and all that stuff, when the only relevance in terms of national security and importance to our country of that story is whether millions of dollars, what the hostile regimes who poured millions of dollars into the Biden family coffers thought they were buying, and what objective evidence do we have, like what we saw yesterday, that they spent pretty well.
Well, to your point about China and what Reagan would have said, making it known that the Chinese protesters, the people, had a friend in the United States, that was the one honest moment from John Kirby, because it's clear that those protesters do not have a friend in the United States. So he's being honest.
That's one way of looking at it. I find it so distasteful. It's just, I mean, we have an evil regime. There are people who are, you know, the bravery that it takes to rise up against, by the way, a surveillance state that has gotten to be a surveillance state by a lot of piracy and a lot of buying off of American technology, which is what they mainly use in order to persecute their people. You have people rising up there just like they're rising up in Iran against an evil regime, and they don't expect us to send troops.
And this is
we're supposed to be the beacon of freedom, right? So when do we start acting like that?
Right. And this is against the backdrop of Jimmy Lai being ready to go go through a show trial where he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison because he refuses to live a lie. I mean, it's just this is like the Solzhenitsyn moment we were talking about earlier in the show, and America is nowhere to be found. It is really, really a sad commentary. I want to go back
You're right.
I want to totally go back right. to. something you were talking about with respect to Biden Inc. You know, since, you know, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, what do you think of the framework that Congressman Jim Comer and Jim Jordan provided the other week about the Biden Inc. investigation that they're going to undertake once they're seated as committee chairs?
I like it. I think it's a good idea. I think they're both smart guys, and they're mindful of the fact that, the country doesn't want a clown show over Hunter Biden, but it's a profound national security question what these countries thought they were buying and why every single country that Obama put Biden in charge of national steering his administration's national security, why people in those countries, many of which or a number of which at least are hostile toward the United States, why they thought it was expedient to pay a lot of money to the Bidens and what they thought they were buying out of it.
Well, and they're buying access to the president, right? I mean,
well, he wasn't president then, but they hoped would be. And he may have been vice president. When we talk about the CEFC deal with Biden, because that's the one we have the most evidence on. That's the one where this guy, Tony Bobulinski, came forward. Mm-hmm. But that Bohai Harvest deal, which is the first one, may be even more lucrative. They help the Chinese obtain dual-use technology, which helps their military, which obviously arms us. And the way Hunter locked that deal in was by hopping a ride with his old man over to China when he was on a trip on behalf of the Obama administration. That's direct involvement of an exploitation of the powers and privileges of the executive branch to strike a deal with an evil regime to get access to funding and economic opportunity, financial opportunities that would not be available to people who weren't attached at the hip to the Chinese Communist Party.
Something Jim Comer mentioned at that press conference that has not gotten a lot of discussion up until that point, these SARs, these special suspicious activity reports, and him talking about there are 150 such reports filed by banks related to transactions by Biden family members, and the House Republicans have only been able to see a couple of them to this point. That seems to me something where there's perhaps a treasure trove of information that starts to connect the dots that haven't been formally connected yet.
Yeah, Dan, that's where criminal investigations start in this kind of a framework. Just so people understand, what a suspicious activity report is with respect to a number of different kinds of financial transactions, including international financial transactions, it's illegal to have these transactions go forward in amounts that go over statutory guidelines. Like I think it's $10,000 for a cash transaction, and it used to be $5,000 for an international transfer of money. You can't do that without filling out what's known as a currency transaction report or an international equivalent of that. So what people do to try to get around those guidelines is they structure their transactions in a way that defeats them. So if you rather than hit $10,000, you go to say, four different banks and do, $2,499, and that way you beat the $10,000 guideline or statutory limit. So banks see this happen. Banks are more aware than anyone else that people are trying to defeat the guidelines. So what they do is they complete what's known as suspicious activity reports, SARs, where they suspect that the person who was engaged in the transaction is trying to defeat the American criminal statutes that apply to these financial transactions. And it's when the banks do that reporting, the banks do it because it's the bank's obligation to file the required currency transaction report. So the banks do it. The banks are in their own interest. They're trying to show that they're not, they're trying to be transparent and comply with the government. And it's usually these kinds of reports that trigger, larger criminal investigations. And when you're talking about having 150 of them and there's a common element, that's a pretty good start to a criminal investigation.
Well, it should be interesting to see what Comer and Jordan unearth in the coming months. He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney and contributing to International Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oh, Christmas music. I love that.
Oh, you're so warm and cuddly during the holiday season, really.
I usually start playing the Christmas music in my car, you know, mid-October. I really want to jump on the holiday season.
Yeah, when you write out your Christmas cards.
Exactly right. Yeah, yeah.
Some
break
hot
out
cocoa by the fire.
Break out the festive sweaters and the whole thing. There's no question. Got to get my tree up. Yeah, a lot of holiday action. But today is Giving Tuesday. And as anybody who's been listening knows, we're partnering with Food for the Poor again this year. We've got a goal, and we need your help to achieve it. The goal for us, in conjunction with Food for the Poor, to feed 1,300 families of four for the next year in places where starvation is a real threat. We're talking about some of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere that Food for the Poor has been serving and working to save lives for four decades. To talk a little bit more about the details of the program and your opportunities to get involved, particularly on this Giving Tuesday, because we have a special deal. Sure, pleased to be joined again by Todd Chatman. He is a spokesman for Food for the Poor. Todd, we enjoyed our conversation so much earlier in the show, we brought you back.
Oh, well, thanks. I'll try to undo any mistakes I made last time.
Well, tell us about this good deal. If people donate today, their donation's going to triple.
Yeah, it's actually going to be tripled because of Giving Tuesday. That offer, this opportunity is good through midnight tonight, Eastern time, so 11 o'clock locally. So if you want to make a difference and feed a bunch more kids than you would normally be able to through Food for the Poor, this is the time to do it. So let me quantify what that looks like. If you could give, so it takes $72 to feed a child in our feeding program, two meals a day for a year. And so you give $72, you're actually feeding three kids today.
That's less than a trip to the grocery store.
Yeah, right?
A fourth of the trip to the grocery store.
So just round it up to $75. $150, you're feeding six kids for a year. And I just got to say, man, we've had like 30 people hop in since I was last with you about an hour ago. So I think this is connecting with people. People are realizing, wow, man, I can do a lot of good for not very much money. So thank you for jumping in on this. And we also had a new business benefactor join us.
Oh, really?
This morning as well. So grateful for
that. And so the business benefactor program, real quick, and we'll get more in depth into it, is a one-time donation of $2,500. It's tax deductible. It's a win-win.
Right.
And as a way of saying thank you, we give you 40 one-minute commercials that air on this station. You're in the radio business. You have been.
Yeah.
That's the best deal in all of Chicagoland radio.
It's amazing.
You can't even get that in smaller markets.
Right?
And this is the third largest city.
Right.
In the country. So if you want to be a business benefactor and take your business to the next level, call Ann Jeanette, 847-472-8951, or just go to 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor. You could see the banner right on our website.
And a lot of our business benefactor advertisers become regular long-term advertisers because we make the phones ring.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity, sort of a trial, if you haven't advertised with us before, and you do good while taking a test drive with us to see if this is something that can enhance your business and your profitability long-term. So it's got that benefit as well. So, Todd, you know, without, you don't have to go all Sally Struthers on us, but sketch out the need that we're talking about when it comes to the countries in which Food for the Poor operates and the families and kids that you serve.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked me that, Dan, because I wanted to, you know, it's easy to talk kind of high level and talk stats and all that stuff, but let's boil it down to a face-to-face interaction that I've had so many times. I mean, I've traveled into our countries almost 40 times in my 12 years working with Food for the Poor, and I got to tell you, it's simultaneously soul-crushing, but also inspiring, because, you know, you're looking at just abject poverty. I mean, you're talking about people that are living in conditions that are simply inhumane. Shacks with holes in the roof. I've seen people living in, 8x8 shacks, and the walls are just tarps that you would put over your patio furniture. dirt floors, no sanitation, no electricity, and then no food. And employment is nearly impossible to find right now, especially coming out of COVID. But I'll never forget, I was in Haiti a few years ago, and we were visiting a family. And like so many conversations I've had, I'm talking to the mom, I'm looking around, and I'm just looking for any signs of food that might be available. You know, sometimes you see a couple pieces of fruit on the shelf, maybe a bag of rice or beans, something. And I didn't see anything. So I asked the mom, I said, have the kids eaten anything today? And it's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And she just kind of sadly shook her head and looked at the ground, because poverty just shames people. Mm-hmm. It's so dehumanizing. You know, as a parent, you're hardwired. It's in our nature just to provide for our kids. That's what we do. And poverty robs you of the ability to do that. But so, you know, she hadn't fed her kids there. She's got like, you know, four little faces looking on. You can just see the hollow look in their eyes. They've just gone without food for too long, and they've got, you know, the pot bellies, all the telltale signs of malnutrition. But I did see a pot of something boiling on the little fire in the corner. So I said, well, it looks like, I'm trying to just pick it up.
Right.
A little bit. It looks like you've maybe got something for this afternoon. And she, through the interpreter, said, well, actually, I've just put some rocks, and I picked some leaves off the tree out mm-hmm. back, and I put some salt in there. And I'm going to give that to the kids before they go to bed. And she said, I know it has, in essence, no nutritional value, but it makes them feel better when they see something cooking, because they have hope that maybe they're going to get something to eat tonight.
And it's such abject poverty. I mean, when we went to Haiti, you can't even describe the poverty level there. Mm. I mean, there's still, the infrastructure is not even in place from the earthquakes that had happened. So yeah. we went to an orphanage, remember, we had to crawl on top of the broken rock
and
the rubble on the street to get to them. And they're just so appreciative for anything, for a warm smile too, or a hug, or just to touch you or touch your hair or just hang out with you. And, you know, we brought soccer balls for them, just this little amount of $72 or even give $100 today, because then it'll be tripled. It makes so much of a difference in this world. And make a donation on behalf of your well-fed kids or grandkids.
Right.
Or, you know, and today's the perfect day to do it, because it's Giving Tuesday.
Yeah. So, you know, give because you know it's making a difference. You're helping, you're truly feeding starving children. But also, and sometimes people bristle when I say this, but do it for yourself, because there's nothing better for your esprit de corps, for your spirit. You know, maybe you're just kind of feeling down in the dumps about life in general. And look, there's a lot of bad news in the world today. But you know what? The best thing to do is to actually light a candle. Right? Make a difference. Do something to help another human being, even though you're never going to meet them. They live in another country. But, man, you can reach into their world that is so hard and relentlessly, you know, difficult and painful and hopeless. And you can bring hope. Imagine a family getting the word that every day for the next year, their kids are going to eat. They probably have never had that news in their life. And you can make sure they get that good news today. Man, what a great opportunity.
And literally, it takes a minute. The operators that are standing by, you just call, and they say how much. They don't mess around. You can literally be in and out of that conversation in 2 minutes. The phone number to call, 844-862-4673. Again, 844-862-4673, or visit 560theanswer.com/food for the poor.
I can give you one more option, too, if I may, real quick.
Oh, yes.
You can actually text if you're in the car and it's just not convenient to make a phone call or whatever. If you text WIND, text WIND to 41444, we'll send you a link to give. So when you get where you're going, just hit that link. You can give your gift online. Just a little hack.
That's good. That's convenient as well. Speak as well to how central food for the poor is in the countries in which you operate. It's clear that you don't have sort of government support programs like we have in the United States, but also there's not a lot of other long-standing nonprofits that do the work that Food for the Poor does.
Yeah, you know, 40 years doing this, 17 countries, and most of the countries we've been in for more than 30 years. We're expanding a little bit now into South America, beginning to do a little bit of work in Colombia, trying to help some of the Venezuelan refugees that are kind of, you know, have collected in Colombia. We're trying to help them. You know, like Haiti, for example, I mentioned earlier this morning, Haiti is in such a bad state right now that a lot of the NGOs operating there have actually stopped. They've just pulled out. So Food for the Poor is really the only NGO of any scale still working in Haiti. And in many of the countries that we work in, we are, if not the largest, one of the largest nonprofits working to help their people. And so, you know, the governments of these countries, they recognize what a lifeline that Food for the Poor is to so many people in their country, And, you know, but again, we can't do that except for generous people here in America that hear what we do and just say, you know, I want to be a part of that. I want to make a positive difference.
I wonder, too, how much you build longstanding relationships with families in the countries and within the communities that you serve, too, where they sort of pay it forward and help get the word out and help, you know, serve their neighbor the way that Food for the Poor serve them.
Yeah, I've had over the years, I've met some, you know, older people now. I say older people, adults, you know, maybe 20s, 30s, who actually benefited from a Food for the Poor feeding program or various opportunity to help them when they were a child. And many of them had a chance to get a better education than they normally would have, you know, for various reasons. And now they came back and have actually joined the work of Food for the Poor and some of our partner organizations. So there's definitely the sense of, hey, you know what, Food for the Poor helped me. And now that I, you know, now I'm gonna give back. I want to help my fellow countrymen. And they recognize that Food for the Poor is a great platform to do that.
And you do more than just feed. You provide medical
medical assistance, supplies.
And build houses.
Yeah, build houses.
We went to that village where they had actual working plumbing and beautiful house. I mean, it was just, you know, it was modest, but it was needed. Because you see people bathing in the same water that they're drinking.
And then
there's an ox down there drinking the same water. It's very bizarre.
Yeah, clean water is a huge need all over the world, but especially, you know, in our countries as well. So we do clean water initiatives. We build homes. We build community centers. We've built a lot of schools over the years. We fund a lot of the feeding programs that actually occur in the schools, which is oftentimes the only place where some of these kids are going to get a decent meal. And so that's a huge, you know, benefit to them. You know, I guess the long and short of it is our goal at Food for the Poor is to really just lift people out of poverty and put them on a path of self-sustainability and give them their dignity back, because poverty robs people of dignity. It just diminishes us.
And you addressed this when you were on earlier, but I think it bears repeating, because since we've been partnering with Food for the Poor at AM 560 for several years now, what's different this year, the challenges that are even more pronounced than they were in previous years?
Yeah, the effects of COVID are, it's got a long tail in these countries. Supply chain issues still plaguing these countries. Food prices are through the ceiling. And, you know, yeah, we're all feeling the pinch of inflation right now. But imagine if you've got an income of, you know, maybe a couple bucks a day, maybe $10 a week, and the bag of rice, you know, that would feed your family for a week, suddenly the price on that doubles. Man, that you just can't absorb that. And so and jobs are hard to find. Wages are low. On every front, COVID has decimated the poorest countries in the world. And it's going to be a long road back to recovery. And so now more than ever, it's important that those of us who have some wherewithal, who have some margin, if you can make a difference, if you can give $75 or $150, you can make a big difference for these families that they don't, man, they're on the line. They don't have any margin left in their life.
And a gift of $144 can feed four children for 1 year.
Six.
Six children now for 1 year.
Yeah.
And if you give $370, you could feed 10 children. Just any donation will be much appreciated.
Yeah,
the number to call, 844-862-4673. 844-862-4673. If you want to text the word WIND, text WIND to 41444, and we'll send you a link where you can donate later today.
Yep.
And don't forget, today there's a force multiplier, the tripling of every dollar that you give as an individual because of a benefactor for Food for the Poor. So, I mean, if you really want to maximize that marginal charitable contribution you're going to make this holiday season, this is a great place to do it.
I like that term, force multiplier.
Yeah.
It's a Dan Prof special.
That's good, yeah, man. I might
he doesn't
that.
Even charge us for that. Oh, yeah, take us. Just, you know, attribution would be great for this. But also, become a business benefactor. And since we spoke at 7 o'clock, now we have, I think, 7 or 8 business benefactors who've signed up. A one-time donation of $2,500, tax deductible, and as a way of saying thank you, we give you 40. I mean, can you imagine 40 one-minute commercials? I could voice it, Dan could voice it, or you can come in and voice it yourself, or have somebody else here voice your commercial. But it will run Monday through Friday from 5 a.m. to 8 p.m. To become a business benefactor, call Ann Jeanette at 847-472-8951, 847-472-8951. Or simply go online to 560theanswer.com/foodforthepoor.
Todd Chapman, spokesman for Food for the Poor. Todd, thanks as always.
Appreciate you. Appreciate it.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.